I'm sure I'm not alone in having seen a great fireworks display and then wondering, how in the heck do they do that? Hi, Larry Mueller here. We're going to find out about that today. Science is an endlessly fascinating topic, and luckily we have Bassam Shakashiri with us, as he comes by every so often to talk about opportunities and challenges in the world of science. He's a professor of chemistry at the UW-Madison, past president of the American Chemical Society. Here to answer your questions as we go along. We'll talk about fireworks, but we can talk about other areas of science as well. Are you a science fan? Where did your love of science come from? Did you have a great teacher or a great parent? That'd be interesting to know. Did you pursue science as a hobby or a profession? And what maybe inspired you? All those things and a whole lot more. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Bassam, welcome back.
Happy to be here, Larry.
It's been a while.
It's been a while. I've been on travel with my responsibilities as the immediate past president of the American Chemical Society, but doing a lot of good things, I assure you, including paying attention to the grand global challenges that face us in science and in society. Perhaps we have a chance to talk about those a bit later.
I certainly hope so. Let's start on a nice light topic, though, although it's heavy in the science in some ways. 4th of July, it's a week from today. And, of course, that means a lot of fireworks displays. What's the science behind fireworks?
Fireworks are very, very exciting. They're striking. They're loud. They're bright. And we celebrate our Independence Day, as you say, a week from today. It's not just the 4th of July. You know, there's a 4th of July in every country. It is Independence Day. It is the celebration and the marking of the values that we cherish so deeply, that are the basis of our democratic institutions. So we enjoy fireworks because they produce light, they produce sound, and they produce heat. They are all characteristics of chemical reactions. And these explosions that take place high up in the air are the result of carefully prepared shells and stars put together by professionals. I want to emphasize that. And then they are released, and they have to stay intact until they get to a certain elevation or a certain height so that we can see them. So there's a lot of science behind this. Of course, fireworks have been known to the Chinese since two, three millennia. But what's attractive to us are the colors, of course.
Yeah, the colors for sure.
And then the sound. And when you're sitting far away from the fireworks display, first you see the light, the beautiful colors, red, blue, orange. Silver colors, all of these are the results of what has been compacted in the shell very carefully. And then you hear the sound. And so light travels faster than sound does. Mm-hmm. And we can estimate how far the fireworks is from where we are very easily. So the use of these chemicals, common chemicals, table salt, sodium chloride, for example, is one of the chemicals packed into the
fire. Is that right?
Yeah. And that's what produces the very bright yellow color. The red color is produced by compounds of the element strontium. The green color compounds of the element copper and barium as well, and a whole slew of other chemical compounds that are put together very carefully and safely by people who know what they're doing. And then they're set off also now electronically. Yeah. The computers control how and when the shells are dispatched up in the air, and we all sit back and we
go,
have
ooh and ah.
And it's fascinating To me, it's fascinating not only to watch the fireworks display itself, but to watch the people watching it.
Yeah.
It's a really, really a fabulous experience. And we're going to be...
you got a couple of events with in connection with 4th of July and fireworks.
Wednesday night at the Memorial Union Terrace.
In Madison.
Beginning at 8 o'clock, between 8 and 9 p.m., I and my colleague Rodney Schreiner, along with Mike LaCrone and members of the UW band and Bucky Badger, will be there to with a short program to demonstrate how the fireworks are put together and how they work. We're going to be doing some experiments there, but we're not going to be setting off fireworks at the Union Terrace. That will be across the lake with Rhythm and Boom's program. And this will precede that by 1 hour. We're going to have a great deal of fun with different mixtures that produce a lot of energy in the form of light. There are going to be some loud explosions. there are going to be colorful emission of light. And, of course, there'll be some heat released, but because we're in the open air, it's going to be dissipated very, very, very quickly. So that's Wednesday at 8 p.m., Memorial Union Terrace in Madison. It's free and open to the public.
And a beautiful setting.
Very beautiful setting.
Right on Lake Mendota.
And so that's on Wednesday.
And then another one.
Another one is Saturday morning at the Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery, where there's an open house between 10 a.m. and noon, open to families, to everyone in the community.
This is also July 6th, right?
That's July 6th. That's also in Madison. But between 10:30 and 11:30, again, my colleague Rodney Schreiner and I will be doing a short program, which we have entitled Flashes and Bangs. So we're going to be explaining more in a more intimate environment than the Union Terrace what goes on when these beautiful displays of chemical transformations are set off high in the air and we see them and we hear them. So two important events next week in Madison.
Bassam Shakashiri, professor of chemistry at the UW-Madison, past president of the American Chemical Society, our guest today as we talk about science education. We've zeroed in a bit here on science of fireworks, and that's fun, too. Give us a call with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or comment there. Let's turn to Bill in Lamira. Bill, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hi. My question has to do with how the flight of this thing is controlled. The commercial fireworks I've seen look like a basketball, and they're shot out of a fairly short tube, you know, only a few feet long. And, you know, I've done some model rocketry, and even a small change in the position of the stabilizer fins on a rocket will send the rocket going in all kinds of unpredictable directions. So I'm wondering, how does this ball flying out of a short tube maintain, a known flight path straight up in the air?
Well, that has to do with the way in which all the different components are put together. So the firework consists of several components. One with a short fuse to ignite it and to get it moving upward. But then there's a longer fuse that is set off when it's in flight. And then at the right height, the right elevation, then the shell explodes. So your question is again related to what I was saying before. These are prepared carefully by people who know what they're doing, and they follow and obey all the safety rules, because fireworks can be dangerous. They're of course very enjoyable to watch, and they appeal to all of our senses. But I want to emphasize the point that it is important to handle them very carefully. So the answer to your question, Bill, is that the way in which that first stage is put together by the professionals is key to getting the firework to go in the right direction. Sometimes it goes at a slight angle. Usually it goes straight up. But that's the answer
to
the question.
And then there's a kind of a booster that comes after it's up.
Yeah.
Sort of like our spaceships that we've
Bill, let me refer you to my website. If you go to my website, scifun.org, scifun.org, on the first page on the left-hand side, you will see an icon, and it says fireworks. And if you click there, we have a brief, we have like a 3-4-page description of what the fireworks components are and how they're put together and what is responsible for the colors that are produced and so on. So have a look there, Bill, when you have a chance, scifun.org.
Yeah, it's a good site for everybody. Bill, thanks a lot for calling. David in Heartland, your turn. Hi, David.
Hi. This is a great program. I've been painting as an artist fireworks for 40 years, and the technology has been amazing, the way they keep improving. And I'd like to ask the question about the designs. For example, 15 years ago, for the first time where I live on Beaver Lake, we had the fireworks, and they had actually heart-shaped fireworks, which totally blew me away. And I've seen some amazing designs, and I was wondering how they do that.
Yeah.
Well, the technology of putting the fireworks together has changed, has evolved. As I said, the Chinese, hundreds of years ago, were the first to develop them, and as far as we know. And then the Italians had made some contributions in the 1830s. So there is a lift, a charge that's put together to lift the all the components together into the air, and the shape of it is important. The position of the different components in it is also important, and Dave, we're not going over the air now to give the instructions on how to construct the firework. But what I'm interested in is having people learn about the different components that are in it, learn about the beautiful displays of color and what causes those colors. And so the little summary that we have on the website addresses your question as well, but we do not give the details of how to construct the firework.
Okay. Thank you. David?
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Talking about science and science literacy today with Bassam Shakashiri. We've zeroed in a bit on fireworks, but, any science topic is a fair game here. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller, Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking science and science literacy today with Bassam Shakashiri, professor of chemistry at UW-Madison. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for listening in today. We've talked about fireworks, and we'll certainly continue to take questions on that as well. I wanted to mention you were given, Bassam, a very prestigious award recently to recognize your decades of efforts in promoting public understanding of science. And I'm certainly congratulations for receiving the Sagan Award, which is a mighty big deal.
Thank you very much, Larry, for mentioning that. Yes, the Carl Sagan Award was given to me by the Council of Scientific Society Presidents very recently, and I'm very pleased and deeply honored. I knew Carl Sagan. Many of us remember Carl Sagan from his Cosmos series. From his appearances on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson and elsewhere, he was an outstanding communicator of science. And it is very pleasing to me to be recognized and have my name associated with Carl Sagan. And of course, Larry, what I try to do on your program, of course, is all about communicating science. Yep. So thank you.
Well, it's a very prestigious award, and you've earned it. You've earned it. Brian in Winona, Minnesota, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's on your mind?
All right. So my question is, with an exponential growth in population and a large reliance on non-renewable energy sources, has Earth reached its maximum carrying capacity, the largest population that Earth can sustain humanity? Huh.
That's a very good question, Brian. I am pleased that you raised this issue, because population growth is at the very top of the grand challenges that we face in science and society. It is estimated that by the year 2050, the population of the planet will be 9 billion people. And at that time, even before that time, our needs for energy will be very difficult to meet. Our needs for water. And I would like, as time permits, Larry, to say a few things about the water crisis, the global water crisis. But let me stick with Brian's question here. The energy demands are just horrendous, not only in the developed world, but in the developing countries. The developing countries want to enjoy the same standard of living, the same high standard of living that we have here. And of course, they're entitled. Everyone, in my opinion, is entitled to benefiting from the great advances in science and in technology. But the energy needs are going to be very, very difficult to deal with. And part of this issue is another grand global challenge, which is climate change. Because our use of fossil fuels now as sources of energy, that usage contributes greatly to increasing the amount of carbon dioxide that is in the atmosphere. Let me be very clear about this point. There are natural causes for climate change, but there is absolutely no doubt whatsoever that human activities have greatly contributed to increasing the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and other greenhouse gases. And that's a result from high usage of energy in terms whether it's in power plants or driving our cars or riding on airplanes. The carbon footprint per person is something we all should be thinking about. And that's why, Brian, I really appreciate you bringing up this this question. There are no simple solutions. What we have to develop are some intelligent choices to maintain our standard of living and allow others around the planet to benefit from the same advances in science and technology. But we have to be careful, exceedingly careful, about the consequences of our high use of energy. Let me also bring into the picture here nuclear energy, because that's a source of clean energy. But we have to be concerned about the waste, the nuclear waste, and where we put it, and the long half-lives of the isotopes that are involved in running the power plants that utilize nuclear energy. So this whole question of our needs for reliable, renewable sources of energy is one that all of us should be concerned about. So thank you, Brian.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Dave in Wanakee, hello to you. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hello. I've heard some alarming things that from population experts that the problem is that at the use that we consume, we're unsustainable to an order of about 100, that we should be 100th of the population we currently are. And I was wondering if that was true.
Well, there are different projections, and that's one of them that you mentioned, but they all point in the same direction, that the population growth is the greatest grand global challenge that we have, and how we deal with it and its consequences affect not only energy, affect our water resources, our food supplies, nutritional food. That also leads to issues related to the way in which we interact with each other socially and politically. There are high population densities all over the world, much greater than what we have in the United States. Those people are going to need food, water. They're going to require great attention in terms of being able to deal with each other peacefully. Population growth is estimated by others to be a major concern in terms of increase in deadly violence and in war. So it's a huge, huge, huge societal problem.
Thank you very much for calling. Bruce in Kenosha County, on to you now. Hi, Bruce. Bruce, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm just switching over.
Okay, well, what's on your mind?
Oh, wow. Well, I was wondering, you know, speaking of renewable and clean energy, what's the status of research into fusion as an energy source?
Mm-hmm. It's still ongoing. The research is ongoing. The results continue to be, let me put it this way, promising, but we haven't realized it yet. There are huge projects, not only in this country, and including the University of Wisconsin-Madison,
yeah,
that deal with this, with the fusion situation. The technology hasn't worked out yet, but that should not prevent us from maintaining our interest in supporting the research in this area, because if it works out, and when it works out, the results will be fabulous and will be very helpful in terms of our energy needs in this country and worldwide.
Yeah. Bassam Shakashiri, our guest today, professor of chemistry at the UW-Madison. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. A little bit later on in the show, Don Stanley will be along to talk about social media and privacy. That's at about 11:45 today. Don is considered an expert in the social media privacy areas, and it'll be fun to hear what he's got to say about what's going on in the social media area. Jim in Dubuque, Iowa, up next. Jim, hello.
Hi. I've been reading recently some information from a recent NASA research report where they did satellite analysis of the atmosphere and the energy coming from solar activity, and found that CO2 and NO in the stratosphere had reflected a lot of this energy back into space, and that actually the CO2 in the atmosphere was helping to cool the planet. I wonder what if he was familiar with this recent research.
It's true that excuse me, it's true that greenhouse gases are good for us. There's no question about that. If it weren't for the greenhouse gas effect with all these chemicals that are in the atmosphere, the surface, the temperature of the surface of the Earth would be like it is at Mars, and life would not exist. So greenhouse gases are good for us because of what you just described, Jim, what you just shared with us, that these molecules reflect radiation back. However, too much of a good thing is not good. That is the problem that we have to face up to, and we're beginning to, in terms of climate change. And the president was very eloquent the other day, just 2 days ago, actually, in outlining what he plans to do and what he wants us to do. And he in three areas, and that is to reduce the emission of greenhouse gases, focus on renewable forms of energy, and then seek international cooperation, because these issues are worldwide. They're not peculiar to any one geographic location. And so the reflection of radiation by the greenhouse gases that are in the atmosphere is correct, as you say, Jim, and that's a good thing for us.
Thank you for calling, Jim. And Marcus in Green Bay, thank you for calling. Hello.
Oh, hello. Thanks for having me on. I was just wondering what the professor thought about President Obama's recent speech. He mentioned and emphasized that we have to do something about climate change, global warming, and, you know, he was pretty stern about it and, you know, caught a lot of people's attention. And I thought that was pretty cool that it's finally getting out there again. It got all hush-hush for so long, and then, you know, it wasn't mentioned. It's never mentioned on, you know, news and everything. So that really got everybody talking about it again. I just wondered what the professor thought.
The president has been consistent in his stand on climate change. In his inaugural address, he mentioned it very prominently. And then 2 days ago, as you say, Marcus, in an excellent speech he gave at Georgetown University, calling attention to what we have to consider and what we must do, not only consider doing it. And I just, as I just mentioned, we need to lower the emission of greenhouse gases from our power plants and other sources. We need to invest in research related to renewable energy, which is what the president's second point is. And the third point is to work on the international scene, because all of these issues are really global issues. So what the president has done is to put out an agenda for action, action on climate change. And what we have to do, the rest of us now, is talk among ourselves about the importance of these issues, but also talk to our elected officials, especially our federal elected officials. I'm talking about our senators, our congressmen and congresswomen. They are the ones who are going to be involved in a conversation, let me put it nicely, with the executive branch of the government about these different matters. Congress has not acted, and that's why the president said on Tuesday he wants to do the three things that were mentioned in his proposal via an executive order. We must have our elected officials be part of the conversation, and it's true that there are differences of opinion about this whole matter of climate change. What is not true is that climate change is unequivocal. Global warming is unequivocal. It is happening. And we should take into account the consequences to us and to the generations after us. We should take into account the huge economic factors, the benefits that can accrue to us from renewable energy sources. And we should take into account also the fact that we have to work in concert with other countries on this very, very important, challenging topic. So the president's leadership is very, very much appreciated by me, Marcus. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much for calling, Marcus. Don in Portage has a question. Hi, Don.
Hey, good morning. You're speaking to Carl Sagan. My question is kind of one, two, threefold. I'm wondering why the Earth is round, and also in that same vein, since it's my understanding that the moon was either part of the Earth that was struck off or flung off, why that appears as round, and a follow-up to that is why was there not left any corresponding ring or crater to that effect?
Well, it turns out that the stable forms of shapes in the universe is the round shape, that has to do with the relationship of the mass of the object, in this case the planet, and the fact that that's how it is the most stable form of it. So when the moon was formed, it was, as you say, ejected from the Earth and took that shape as well. I don't know if there are objects in the universe that are not round in shape. I'm going to have to look into that. This is one of the great things about being on your show, Larry. I get all these questions and I start thinking about even better explanations than the ones we're giving now. So.
All right. So it's something to look forward to. Don, thank you for calling. Jocelyn in Sheboygan, it's your turn next. Hi, Jocelyn.
Hi. I'm very upset about the way the world is going. You know, it seems like it runs on corruption. And there must be some way to get the scientists where they're out front and speaking louder than the people that are denying what is going on. I mean, the perfect example, you just have to look at China with all the, and we're fueling it because we're buying their products, you know, and we send our factories over there because they don't have the strict pollution laws. I am just so frustrated. It just doesn't seem, why can't there be like some kind of huge program or project to let all these scientists come out and talk louder than these talk people, you know, that...
We should be doing what you're saying, Jocelyn. More scientists should come to the forefront and communicate the value of science to society. There's no question about it. I've dedicated my life to being part of that effort. I understand your frustration, and I hope that the energy that you're spending to deal with your frustration can be harnessed and focused on being constructive about it by exactly what you're doing now. You're raising the question, but you must know some people in your community and elsewhere who are scientists and so on. Ask them the same question that you're asking here. Urge them to participate in the conversation. You know, the gap between the science-rich sector and the science-poor sector in society is widening at a very alarming rate. We know a lot now in science that we didn't know even 10 years ago, let alone 100 years ago. And so it's through education, public education, at public institutions and private institutions, that we communicate what science is, what the benefits of technology can be, and what the potential hazards of these advances in science and technology are. That's why we should be focusing, in my opinion, foremost on the quality of education that takes place not only in the schools, not only at colleges and universities, but the public education, because the public discourse about this matters, specifically climate change, in our state and elsewhere, Jocelyn, is not at a very good level. There are deniers. They are fellow human beings. I have the highest respect for every human being. It doesn't mean I respect their ideas, but I want to engage in a conversation with them about why the consequences of climate change can be catastrophic to us if we do not do something about them. And what the something is the subject of what President Obama has put forward, and it is to be considered seriously rather than dismissed and ridiculed by our elected officials in Washington and elsewhere. So the public discourse, Jocelyn, is exceedingly important, and that's what we should be doing.
We had a Facebook question from Steve, who says, we see scientists from all countries working together for the common good at the Large Hadron Collider in CERN. On our own UW-Madison campus, gathering weather data from countries around the world, bringing forth innovation at our institutes for discovery and countless other examples. What lessons can we learn from scientists and the way they collaborate to heal some of our other hopelessly broken institutions?
Well, you know, science is a human endeavor, and scientists ask questions. They spend a lot of time formulating the questions so that we get a fighting chance of getting some reasonable answers. What we're engaged in here is combating ignorance. And what scientists do when they work together, they compare notes, they challenge each other, they get into heated discussions, arguments. They want to be first in reporting a discovery and so on. As I say, science is a human endeavor. But what we can learn is that by collaboration and cooperation, by being respectful in the endeavors that we pursue, whether they are social endeavors or scientific endeavors, we can make progress. We can make constructive progress. Of course, we encounter failure here and there. You know, a lot of the scientific experiments that are tried fail. We learn from failures. So what scientists do is treat each other with respect and with civility. That is something that is missing in several of our public discourses. That is the element of respect and to be civil in the way we talk to each other and the way we want to put the conversation forward, rather than engage in name calling or engage in statements that are meaningless and are vacuous. We are responsible citizens in this country, and we deserve the best from ourselves and from the people that we elect. And so my plea is to engage in these meaningful conversations that are full of value and respect, even though there may be vastly opposing points of view. That is crucial to making progress, to take the opposing point of view into consideration. But to simply deny something when the facts speak for themselves, that does not make a good conversation. And that's what we do in science, and that's my answer to your question as to what other societal institutions can benefit from the way scientists collaborate with each other here at UW-Madison, in Europe, everywhere.
And on that note, we have to part company at least for today. But Sam, thank you so much for taking time to be with us. I do want to mention again, July 3rd, the evening of July 3rd, 8 o'clock, at the Memorial Union Terrace on the UW-Madison campus, Bassam Shakashiri and Rod Schreiner are going to present Science and Fireworks, Sights and Sounds for Independence Day. And they're going to have, and Mike LaCrone will be there and Bucky Badger, and there's going to be lots of fun, some loud noises. And then you'll have a chance to watch the fireworks from across the lake, too, at 9 o'clock, because they'll talk right up to the time of the fireworks. And then July 6th, he is at the forum at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery from 10:30 to 11:30. To present Science of Flashes and Bangs, again with Rod Schneider. So some fun things coming up for 4th of July and before it and after it. But Sam, thanks again.
Happy Independence Day to everyone.
Always a lot of fun to talk with Bassam Shakashiri about the incredible ways that science can improve our lives. Coming up next, Don Stanley with us to take us into the world of social media. Don always has great information to share, so I hope you'll stay tuned right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.